production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
Food is about kinship. Food is about love. Food is about generosity and hospitality. Food is about cultural identity. And all of those factors were neglected when they were given macaroni.
This week, we're rebroadcasting one of my favorite interviews from this year with Elizabeth Dunn, professor of geography and international studies at Indiana University. Elizabeth Dunn is also a food scholar. She studies food and immigration. In this interview, she shares stories with Alex Chambers from her fieldwork in refugee camps in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. And from Chef Daniel Orr, we have a tasty idea for fall radishes. And it's Fun Drive here at WFIU, and a great chance to let us know how much you appreciate original, locally produced shows like Earth Eats. So stay tuned.
Is your mug collection in need of an overhaul?
I have a mug that says, "Tick tock, don't stop," because when I'm running late in the morning, I really want to feel even more anxious.
It's shaped like a block of cheese, and there's a mouse head poking out the side.
I have this terrible mug. I don't even know where I got it. It's covered in text, and it says, "Age is like underwear. It creeps up on you."
Real people, and they're really, really bad mugs. If it's time to purge those bad coffee mugs, why not replace them with one of the WFIU mugs?
We've got exactly what you need to brighten up your mug collection. If you like waking up to WFIU with a cup of coffee or your favorite tea, we have the handsome Early Bird mug with a stylish graphic of a cardinal and a burst of sunshine. The mug itself is a sturdy diner-style coffee cup with the WFIU and NPR logos on back. Become a sustaining member at $10 a month, and the mug is yours. Go to WFIU.org to pledge your support right now. Thank you. We talk about radishes in the spring, but like most cool weather crops, you can also grow radishes in the fall. You might have some in your garden right now. And they grow so quickly, it's probably not too late to get some planted. Put some lettuce seeds down too while you're at it. And arugula. In any case, you can find radishes at your farmer's market this fall. And now with my favorite radish recipe, Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington Restaurant.
I'm going to make some radish sandwiches. Now you can see here, I brought in some radishes from my own garden. I've taken a few of those and washed them, and I'm going to just slice them into thin rondelles. Okay, and I love having different colored radishes. There's white radishes, there's the icicle radishes, there are French breakfast radishes, all different kinds. So you can mix it up and play with all those different kinds. And this is a very typical French way to eat radishes, and it's with lots of butter, some sea salt, and a baguette. All right, baguette, of course, is a classic French bread. We're going to cut it into quarters. And one trick about French bread, a lot of times when you bring it home from the supermarket or even the bakery, it won't be really crispy and fresh like you want your baguettes to be. What you do is you have your oven preheated to 450, 500 degrees. You put your whole baguette underneath the running faucet of water, let it get soaked on the outside, pop it into that hot oven for about 5 to 7 minutes, And the steam is going to push the moisture into the baguette, and it's going to crust the exterior of the baguette. And you're going to have, it's going to be like it was just freshly cooked. And even if you have a stale 3-day-old baguette, you can do the same thing with that. If it's already cut, just put a little extra water on the cut end, pop it in that hot oven, and you're good to go.
That is a great tip.
Okay, and I'm just going to cut this down the middle, so I've got the two halves of the baguette. We're going to put a nice slab of butter on each side. Now, if you wanted to, you could take the butter and season it with some salt and pepper and fresh herbs, a little lemon juice, lemon zest, but we're just going to keep it simple. I'm going to put a few scallions on it. I am going to sprinkle it with a little bit of regular salt and a little bit of cracked black pepper. Okay, and then we're going to layer those radishes on, almost like fish scales. And these are great. You can make them a little bit smaller as kind of like tea sandwiches if you want to have, you know, kind of a high tea kind of feel, or just have them the way I'm making them now, more of a sandwich, open-faced sandwich. And we're just going to serve these with a little bit of local arugula from Good Life Farms. And this will be a super nice light lunch. I'm going to press them down to really get that butter to hold the radishes in place. Okay, and then to finish it off, I'm going to add a little bit of coarse sea salt. I'm using a sel gris from Brittany, a Brittany sea salt. Here, we're going to put these on the plate with a little bit of this local arugula that Darren and Debbie grow over at Good Life Farms. And then I always like to make a little shine on it with some extra virgin olive oil. That's about as simple and as about as good as it can be.
It's my favorite way to eat a radish.
You'll find a photo of this lovely sandwich, along with the recipe and many other recipes for radishes, all on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
I'm Elizabeth Dunn. I'm a professor of geography and international studies at Indiana University.
Elizabeth Dunn is also a food scholar. She studies food and immigration. In a compelling piece in the Iowa Review called A Gift from the American People, she writes about how food is so much more than a substance that keeps us alive. It's so much more than mere calories. She reflects on the approach of humanitarian aid organizations that often fail to understand this when providing food aid to displaced people. Alex Chambers spoke with Elizabeth Dunn in our studio recently. He asked her about her experiences working in refugee camps in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. In 2008, Russian forces moved into a Georgian province called South Ossetia on the border between Georgia and Russia. Conflict in the region had led to an ethnic cleansing campaign, pushing the ethnic Georgians out of South Ossetia and into Georgia proper.
Their homes were bombed, aerially bombed, and then looted. I mean, wires ripped out, pipes stolen for scrap metal, roofs ripped off. And then those houses were burned. And then in some cases, they were bulldozed to make sure that these people could never go home again. And they were shoved out across the border into Georgia proper, where they became internally displaced people. And, you know, we talk a lot about refugees, but in a strict definition, refugees are people who've crossed an international border. But the overwhelming majority, two-thirds of the world's displaced people, are not refugees. They're internally displaced people. They have not crossed an international border. The people I worked with the help of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR, were put into camps, which were, they were then told by the Georgian government, were permanent, that they were going to be there for the foreseeable future. And these are camps right on the border.
Most of these internally displaced people, also known as IDPs, were farmers, and they were forced from their communities in the month of August,
which is right before the harvest season. So they had nothing to subsist on, and so they were dependent on the World Food Program, which is actually the largest provider of humanitarian aid in the world. So they lived on World Food Program packages for more than a year, which meant macaroni three times a day, every day, for almost 18 months, actually.
So what's the problem with macaroni?
So let me start by telling you what the advantages of macaroni are.
Oh, that'd be great.
So macaroni is really useful for the World Food Program because it's a durable staple, which is light and easy to transport. For the same reason, I mean, it's much lighter than wheat flour. It's lighter than rice, and it's more durable, actually. So it's really, for wheat-eating populations, it's really a preferred substance. So the World Food Program also has a target number of calories that every displaced person should get every day. I think it's like 2,340. And so macaroni is like caloric filler. It gets them up to the number of required calories. And one of the things that's really interesting about that approach to providing food to people is it takes a purely biological approach. It assumes that the goal of aid is not to restore people socially or to integrate them into local communities or to give them back their professions and their kinship relations, which have been literally blown apart. It assumes that the point of aid is for people to survive another day. And it's like Groundhog Day, right? Every day is the next day. And you are thought of, once you're a refugee or an IDP, you're thought of only in biological terms, right? I mean, you have no distinguishing characteristic. Everybody gets the same amount of food, no matter if they're working hard in the fields or, you know, they're invalids laying around. Men and little babies get the same 2,340 calories a day, right? So it reduces people to the biological minimum. And the anthropologist Peter Redfield has referred to this as biopolitical minimalism. And that's what people were confronting. But food is so much more than that, right? Food is about kinship. Food is about love. Food is about generosity and hospitality. Food is about cultural identity. And all of those factors were neglected when they were given macaroni.
Yeah.
The interesting thing was that for Georgians, macaroni is sort of not food. I mean, they have macaroni. It was an import from the Russians. But it doesn't have a place in the grammar of Georgian cuisine, which is exquisite, by the way, which is just like so good. You know, pomegranates, walnuts, really deep beef flavors, steamed dumplings the size of your fist that are full of soup. And this is Georgian cuisine, right?
Wow.
It's exquisite. And macaroni is because it's a Russian import, it's either eaten boiled, plain, sometimes sprinkled with sugar, or it's cracked in, you know, spaghetti's cracked into soup. But those are the only two ways you eat macaroni in Georgia. It's just, macaroni is the food that you eat when you are too poor to eat anything else. So what was really interesting to me was that I started interviewing people about the aid they were receiving, and they would say over and over, nothing. What have you gotten here? Nothing. And I'm like, wait a minute, I see the bags of macaroni under your bed, and I see that you're in this little cinder block cottage, and I see these ratty little stools that you were given, and bare pine floorboards. It was not luxurious, but it's something. And for them, it was nothing. It didn't count for anything. And macaroni, because it's not food that you can host other people with. Georgians have a long tradition of a ritual banquet, and these banquets break out at I mean, spontaneously break out at different moments, but they're extremely ritualized and they demand certain kinds of food. And you can't host people at a banquet and serve them plain boiled macaroni. I mean, that's absolutely a shame. So
what would the foods be?
Oh, my God. I have seen, I mean, at a big Supra, the goal is to make sure that you cannot see the table, that the dishes are piled up in so many layers, balancing the edge of one plate on the other, that you literally cannot see the table underneath it. So sulguni cheese, romi, which is a corn pudding with smoked cheese in it. There's an eggplant pate that's molded into balls and a beet greens pate, which is molded into balls. Delicious. With walnuts, actually. It's a kind of a paste of walnuts and beet greens. There is badrushani nivsit, which is strips of fried eggplant rolled around a paste made of parsley, cilantro, walnuts, herbs. I mean, just it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So and amazingly, at many Supras, I have eaten until I could burst. And then they say, well, that's it for the cold food. Here comes the hot food. So the food is elaborate. And it's really culturally and religiously important to them. And when the banquets had to stop, that was in many ways a real detriment to their kinship relations, to their attachments to their neighbors from their villages, to their familial relations. I mean, inside the nuclear family, religion. I mean, this is a religious event every time it happens, one of these banquets. So that's detrimental. You can't practice your faith with macaroni. So macaroni posed a lot of sort of existential problems. So people's response to that is, generally negative.
Yeah.
They see it as degrading, which it is.
Yeah.
They see it as disempowering because you don't even have the choice to choose what you eat. I ask my students very often, imagine you were in an earthquake and the Japanese came to provide aid. And what they brought you was a really common Japanese snack, dried squid heads. How many dried squid heads would you eat?
Yeah.
So I think people really, really rebelled against the macaroni. They really felt that it marked the erasure of their entire social identities. It was nothing food because they were nothing people.
You say at one point in the article that the humanitarian food aid keeps people in limbo in camps.
Well, so camps in general keep people in limbo.
Right.
Camps are meant to be temporary, which is why they very often have tents. Now, the average length of stay in a refugee camp is 17 years. That's the average length of stay. Of course, the record holders are the Palestinians. They've been there 70 plus years. So what they are is permanently temporary. In a camp, you're always waiting to go back. You never really settle into a camp. It's always just until we can go back. And yet that just until can last decades. It can last generations. So the way we think about camps really has to change. The food in the camps is a part of that limbo, largely because the food aid does not do much to respect their culture, their traditions. It does not do very much to leverage what they can grow or produce themselves. And I think because it's aimed just at biological reproduction, it is, for most people, food that is without meaning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And worthless.
And worthless, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You talk in the article, though, too, about some of the ways that people manage to bring back some of their living food traditions.
So one of the things that people in this part of the world have done since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 is do a ton of home canning. And one of the things that really, really hurt when their villages were destroyed is that they lost all their jars. And those jars are expensive. They're about one lari a piece, and you need about 400 of them. For a family for the winter. And nobody had 400 laris for this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was a very large sum of money. So they really needed to get those jars back. And so I have a really good friend who in the book I call my Nana. She says to me, oh, look, you have your friend's car here. Let's go for a ride. Let's go to my cousin's for lunch. I'll tell you what, let's go get my jam jars. And I'm like, okay, what are we doing? So she leads me down the road, and I have no idea that what we are doing is driving towards the conflict zone. So we hit the Georgian checkpoint, right? And there's this guy, and he's got an American M5, which is a very, very large gun. And he's like, what are you doing here? And I start babbling in Georgian, like, oh, yeah, I'm here with my friend, and we wanted to make jam, and, you know, her jars are there, so we need to go get the jars. And so, yeah, so we're here. We're going to make jam, strawberry jam. And he looks at me like, God, you are stupid. And at first, it's unbelievable. Like, why would an American be driving into the buffer zone to make jam, right? So he's like, I can't authorize this. You're going to have to go see the commander. So we drive kind of bumping down this rutted road, and we get to the village of Mereti. And at there, this is the actual dividing line now between the Russian and the Georgian armies. And we pull up, and there's a bunker, like a sandbags bunker with that camouflage netting over the top. And out comes this guy and in camouflage fatigues, and he's like a slab. Like, you know, one of those guys who's so muscle-bound he can't actually close his armpits, right? So he comes out, and he's like, what are you doing here? And we're like, oh, yeah, we're here to make jam. Yeah, jam, that's the ticket. You know how it is, jam. You got to make jam. It's August. And I'm just babbling away as fast as I can babble. And he looks at me, and, like, the light breaks over his face. And he realizes that we're not spies. We're just idiots. And he's like, oh, this is entertaining, right? Because it's boring sitting there. The two armies aren't fighting. They're at a standoff. And so he invited us to sit down and have coffee with him and tell him all about what we were doing. And at the end, he let us go. And we went into the village of Mereti, and there Manana goes into her cousin's house, goes down into the basement, and reappears with this giant bag full of jars, glass jars. And I'm like, what? Whoa, Manana, where did you get these? I mean, how did you get your jars back? Her house was across the border inside the conflict zone. It was occupied by the Russian 58th Army. If you crossed that border and they caught you, they would either sentence you to a 5-year prison term or they'd shoot you on the spot. So I'm like, where did you get these? And she's sort of like, la, la, la. And it turned out that her husband had managed to obtain a false passport. And he's a smuggler by trade, and he was moving things back and forth across the border. And he had gone to the ruins of their house, and he had gone into the basement, into the cellar, and the jars had not been broken during the war. The house was decimated. The walls were torn down. The roof was off. But the jars were still there, and she said he cried, actually, that he started weeping, and then he got super, super drunk and spent the night in the cellar. And then in the morning, he came out and brought all her jars out, and he had spirited them across the border to Mereti, where we were picking them up. So, wow. So that's how important those jars were to them. I think what's really important about those jars is that they enabled people to start making their own food by choice again, food that had a provenance, food that was from a defined place, and that would circle through networks of kin and friends. Like, people trade jars so that they get different foods, so that they vary their diet. And you know always when you open a jar, like, who made it, where it's from. Those were jars. That was food that connected people to one another, and it was super important.
The global refugee crisis is growing at an alarming rate. There are more than 22 million refugees worldwide. People living in the temporary, permanent limbo of life in a refugee camp. Rohingya Muslims in Bangladesh, Syrians in Georgia, 2.5 million people internally displaced in Yemen. The list goes on. In the midst of such a crisis, can global aid organizations even begin to rethink how camps are designed or the way food is provided? With growing numbers of people living their lives in these conditions, can they afford not to? Find links to more information and resources at eartheats.org.
Hey, Kate.
Hey, Alex. What's up?
Well, it's Fun Drive Week, and I've been thinking about this episode of Home of the Brave I was just listening to.
You mean that Scott Carrier podcast, Home of the Brave?
Yeah, that one.
I love Scott Carrier.
Yeah, me too. So in this episode, he was talking with Alex Chadwick about the early days of NPR.
Yeah, I think I remember that one. They're going to the beach. It's raining.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're on the beach, and Chadwick is telling Scott Carrier how before he worked at NPR, he'd been in commercial television. And he noticed a big contrast when he went over to NPR, because in commercial television, he felt like the people who worked there, they didn't respect their audiences. They kind of thought they were stupid, actually. Everyone at NPR thought their audiences were smart, so much so that they had to work as hard as they could to be as smart as their audience was.
Wow. Yeah. So NPR seems to have really been founded on that notion. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly what we're trying to do here at WFIU and what we're trying to do here at Earth Eats, I would say. I mean, we love to share the recipes with, you know, all that fresh seasonal food. We enjoy conversations with chefs and bakers and cider makers. But we also don't shy away from those complex issues about our food systems, about food sovereignty, food justice. A good example of that is our conversation today with Elizabeth Dunn. It's about how cultural traditions around food matter, even in a crisis.
And she tells some amazing stories.
That too. And listeners, if you appreciate this work, let us know.
So Alex Chadwick also said about the early days of NPR, the audience found NPR and the audience saved NPR.
Wow. When,
yeah, before it was really fully established. But that continues to be the case. Listeners, we rely on you. So please go to WFIU.org, become a member, renew your membership, become a sustaining member with a monthly commitment, whatever you can afford.
Let us know you like what we're doing here on Earth Eats. And thank you.
Yes, thank you.
That does it for our show this week. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Elizabeth Dunn. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey.
I'm Kate Young, and I thank you for listening to Earth Eats. If you're listening to Earth Eats as a podcast, we really want to hear from you. Make a pledge at eartheats.org. No amount is too small, and it lets the station know that people listening to podcasts care about Earth Eats. It makes a huge difference. Thank you. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows. Helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com.